But I doubt if anything has happened that's more important, that has more widespread consequences, both good and troublesome, than this trip to Jackson. One does not express appreciation and gratitude to someone who acts out of conscience. And I find that the older I get, the more shopworn becomes my grab bag. But I think of the little girl who responded to the solicitor, who thanked her very much for the very generous contribution she'd made to the church. She said, "Well, but I didn't give it to you." Nevertheless, we are grateful and we are proud. At the same time, we are humbled. We are humbled in the presence of this example. We are also humbled by the nature of the responses that have come, both good and bad. I think you'll discover, if you've not already discovered, that in anything like this, or I suppose it's most prevalent in a financial campaign, that you're always surprised. You're never quite prepared to get the best, get the worst, where you had every right to expect something a little better. I think actions are more important than reactions, and the action stands, and I don't intend to detract from it by keeping on talking, because I'm aware that you did not come to hear what I had to say about this experience, except that you wanted to know and express for you, to know of my pride and express this for you. I want to say this concluding word, that these men have walked right into the middle of trouble and suffering, which will involve every one of us before this chapter is concluded. There are most things we have in this school, and we've been proud of everything. From time to time, each one of us have felt that the bond of fellowship, of unity, could perhaps be better. And each one of us has asked, as we've noted this deficiency, is it I? I'm saying that I think we have a wonderful opportunity to permit this, to add to the strength and the depth of our love, and this will be good for our souls. We want to divide this report up so that you get some perspective, and we'll go this way. You need some background as to what was in minds of persons who made this trip, and then the matter of reporting on what happened. Conversations with the ministers and laymen in Jackson, the account of the visit to the church, the account of the arrest and the trial. Dr. Hopper is going to speak first about the background, the philosophy.
You'll recognize we all feel under considerable pressure of time here. We've had occasion to carry on extensive discussions and considerations before, during, and after the recent events, and have a great deal more to say than could be done on any one of these topics in the time available. We have to move very rapidly. We did feel the background here, more I think, not in terms of philosophy, which is in the written document that you have, theology I'd rather say, I suppose, but in terms of events, what quickly was the situation there in Jackson, Mississippi, And then secondly, how do we get into it? And how do we proceed? Now, this is too complex to cover fully, but you people who have been drawn into this, in a sense, by our activities, I think have a right to know this. I'll try to be very quickly here. You'll recall that on October the 6th of this year, Worldwide Communion Sunday, three girls, Methodists, attempted to go to worship at a Methodist church and participate in the Holy Communion, were arrested, put into jail, hastily convicted without access to legal aid. The story was broken very quickly in the Chicago newspapers because one of those girls was from Chicago. And Methodist ministers and laymen in Chicago and vicinity quickly responded in an attempt to develop a campaign, both to defend these girls and begin to try to root out this blasphemy and apostasy in a portion of the Methodist church. It may be worth noting that the Methodist seminary world was very quickly involved because our seminary, which is just north of Chicago, was in the midst of this immediate reaction. A convocation of the entire school was held, and they determined at that point that they would attempt to raise funds themselves. And President Dwight Loader of the Garrett School of Theology became the treasurer for the organization that was set up to try and deal with this situation. Ministers and laymen, mostly ministers, however, began to travel to Jackson, Mississippi. And over a period of time during the fall, if the figure is accurate, the figure I have would indicate that some 23 persons were arrested and many others were simply turned away as a strategy of the White Citizens Council, which dominates in Jackson, Mississippi, all official activities, varied from week to week. During the fall, a report was issued by a commission of 36 from the National Council of Churches, a study of the state of Mississippi, the essence of which, put in very brief form, is we must recognize that we have in Mississippi a situation appallingly comparable to the situation in Nazi Germany during the 1930s. Our visit gave us nothing to suggest that this was in any way an overstatement, to put the matter mildly. The visits of these group of ministers, including various organizations such as Methodist Church Renewal, which partially grew out of Methodists in various parts of the country, coming up to attempt to face up to what this implied about our church, that this kind of a thing was allowed to persist. These visits were terminated when there were promises that there were going to be negotiations which were going to seek responsibly to find a way to eliminate this shame from that part of our church. The negotiations proved to be empty and meaningless, and finally word reached us this spring that the White Citizens Council had concluded that Methodism had been defeated, that segregation in the Methodist Church, in the white Methodist churches, was assured in Jackson, Mississippi, and a campaign was mounted by the White Citizens Council to resegregate the integrated Episcopal churches in that city. The Episcopal churches and the Roman Catholic churches there are integrated, as are various of their other activities. Methodism, in other words, was judged by them as by us to have failed to meet responsibly this incredible situation. An appeal was sent out, again, appealing not too long ago that Easter Sunday, what we might call the highest holy day of the Christian year, would be a time to again try to bring to their attention that Methodism is not composed entirely of people who are indifferent to the sufferings and the apostasy that exist in various parts of our church, and that a witness was needed here. And specifically, the appeal was made that perhaps seminarians, meaning professors, would be able to do something here, since pastors normally, as you would judge, are fairly well occupied on Easter Sunday. When this message was received, it was relayed to me, and I conferred with one or two colleagues about this possibility, and two of us decided immediately that we would respond, and we sent for further information. Response to that was very slow in coming, and when it came, there was very little information present. And so with very little time left, we had done very little planning. And at this point, one of the persons on our faculty, whom I had talked to casually, I had frankly not been in touch with the majority of our faculty members about the matter, suggested that it might be much more meaningful if instead of it just being that we received the message and we responded, this was something that was done by Methodist theological teachers from various parts of the country. And we proceeded then, beginning at a point where there were just 9 days before departure, to contact individual persons on the faculties of all the other Methodist seminaries, and in one instance, a Methodist faculty member of an interdenominational seminary. And of course, they had very little time to consider this, very little preparation for understanding exactly what we had in mind, but we got a variety of responses. In general, they were responses that indicated that they wanted to participate. In some cases, they could not. We received word then that Drew University School of Theology, the faculty meeting in official session, had voted as a faculty that they wanted to participate and proceeded to select a faculty member to be sent at their expense to represent them in this situation. That was the first word we had that we would not be alone in this. Subsequently, Dr. Thompson Garrett and Dr. Henry Clark from Union Theological Seminary also joined us, and we then went, leaving here early on Good Friday morning to travel to Jackson. One other thing I think that should be made clear is that we did attempt, when our plans became somewhat clear at this late stage of the game, to communicate to all the members of our faculty what we were planning to do. And other members of our faculty, I made it clear that they wanted to participate, but that at this late date, it was no longer possible to make the arrangements which would be necessary for them to be away for the days involved. I would say basically this is the background, and we'll hasten on from there.
I've been asked to discuss our visits with people in Jackson, Mississippi while we were there. Our visits were rather extensive, and we pressed a good deal of talking into a short period of time. I think we might say that we encountered two churches during the course of our visit in Jackson, Mississippi. You will recognize that these are fast oversimplifications and will react accordingly and read between the lines, I hope. And I'm speaking with respect primarily to this particular issue with which we are concerned. We might describe one of them as the Conforming Church. And the Conforming Church here would include most of the white laymen and certainly most of the white ministers in Jackson, Mississippi. But I will make a distinction here between the Conforming Church in Torment and the Conforming Church in the South. And when I refer to the Conforming Church in Torment, I'm talking about the people such as the pastor with whom we talked, the pastor of a very prominent church, a man with a good theological education, a man of considerable ability, who is in torment because he is caught in a conflict between a conscience which he cannot forget on the one hand and a culture which he dares not oppose on the other. He recognizes that something has to be done. He hopes that it will be left to Mississippians to do it. When we asked him what he proposed to do, he said that if he did anything, he would immediately be expelled from his pulpit. And we asked him when he proposed to start doing something about it, if he felt something should be done. He says, well, when I get a new district superintendent and a new bishop. We asked him then, do you think that you will get the kind of leadership at the next annual conference and the next jurisdictional conference in the Methodist Church in this area that will enable you to do what should be done? His response was, no. That is the church in Torment. Our conversation with this person as the representative of this branch of the church in Mississippi, I think, troubled us perhaps more than any other, because it is not the vocal majority in Mississippi that keeps things as they are. It is the silent minority who recognize that things as they are impossible, but will do nothing about it. The second branch of the Conforming Church may be described as the church in the South. And I'm talking here about the Methodist ministers and others like them whose name in Mississippi I would say is perhaps Legion. I'm talking here about the people like those with whom we talked Saturday evening. The dean called at the invitation of Bishop Franklin, at the suggestion of Bishop Franklin, a prominent official of the Mississippi Methodist Church, and he asked three ministers to come to his meeting with him. And we got a liberal theological education.
liberal in the sense that we were exposed to ideas which we'd never heard before, and an interpretation of Scripture which was wholly novel to us. And I think you should take very seriously the statement in that appeared in the Delaware paper yesterday, that these men espouse a segregationist theology and politics. That is no understatement. I think on any fair assessment of racism, you would have to say they are confirmed racists. One of them, for example, would ask the question of whether he saw any incompatibility between the gospel and segregation. He said no. And in support of this fact, he cited an experience of his in which he had preached in a Negro church, a thing which he says he never should have done, because they have one temperament and we have another temperament. And our temperaments just can never go together. They can never blend. And then he proceeded to give us an interpretation of the story of the Good Samaritan to illustrate his point. The Good Samaritan was on his way down the road, and Jesus tells a story about it, not to illustrate, and no point should be made of the fact that this man who helped the person in need was a Samaritan, because if he had gone on down that road to the church where the priest and the Levite were, he would not have been welcome. But this didn't keep Jesus from praising him, or it didn't provoke him to suggest that there ought not to be this separation of Samaritans and Jews. A segregationist policy and beyond. Then there is another church in Mississippi which we encountered, the Transforming Church. It is a church in the minority, but I think it is a remarkably free church. And as you look at this branch of Christendom in Mississippi, you cannot help but be impressed with the similarity between this wing of the church and the church at the time of its origin, as you learn about it in 1 Peter and Revelation. Because these people, though in captivity, are not really captives. Because they recognize that the Lord of the church is not the governor of Mississippi, not the bishop of white Methodism in Mississippi, but Jesus Christ. And they are determined to press this loyalty, whatever the consequences and whatever the cost. I would mention here our discussion Saturday evening with a group of Negro ministers, some 15 or so ministers and laymen. I suppose approximately 12 of them were ministers. And they are determined to take whatever steps are necessary to secure freedom for their fellow human beings. And they are anxious, in view of the pressures which are brought to bear against them and their children, to have all the outside help possible. And I would mention then, as a second wing of this Transforming Church, certain whites in Mississippi, such as those with whom we talked, they were primarily white Saturday morning, a few ministers from the Mississippi Annual Conference and some professors in colleges there. They are systematically harassed and intimidated. The two college professors there, one was given a contract for next year on the promise that he would leave year after next. And the second, who has been there for 12 years, has come to the point that he feels it is impossible any longer to try to rear his children in the Christian tradition in this environment, and he wonders whether he can survive after another year. I think I can sum it up with an illustration of two former students I had from Mississippi. I was in Mississippi in February at the State MSM Conference, where I served as a platform speaker. And at the end of the first day, a former student who is now an officer in the Mississippi Annual Conference spent an hour to an hour and a half trying to justify himself in my eyes for a letter which had been signed, written and sent to the Jackson Clarion Ledger over his signature. If I were to mention his name, Dr. Foster, you would recognize it immediately. And he said that he didn't write this letter. It was read to him over the phone, and he wouldn't have written it himself, but it was in reaction to a meeting of the National Council of Churches in Nashville, in which Colin Williams called upon the students to join in the civil rights movement and to participate in this movement, to join in activities to help bring release from the captivity and segregation of the church in the South. And they made three points in that letter. One is, we were not there. The Methodist Church of Mississippi is not in sympathy with what went on there, and we do not want our young people, white or Negro, to participate in such activities. I was glad that he felt constrained to make an apology for having allowed his signature to appear under this letter. And then there's another student about whom I would like to tell you, and with that I close. He is a minister in the city of Jackson. He met with us Saturday morning. He grew up in Mississippi, went to school at Millsaps College in Jackson. He went to a district superintendent recently, or to some official of the Methodist Church in Mississippi, and he said, what is the future for me in the Mississippi Conference? And he was told, you have no future in the Mississippi Conference. As of a month from now, he will go into the chaplaincy in the armed services. If you were to ask me why I felt constrained to go to Jackson, I cannot forget that this person was a former student of mine, and I do not believe that we seminary professors ought to persist in the teaching of doctrine in our classrooms, which cannot be proclaimed from our pulpit.
I think I have the simplest assignment of any of our group, that is to tell you what happened on Sunday morning. In a very matter-of-fact account of events as they transpired. Saturday afternoon, we were given some instructions about how to conduct ourselves in the event that violence broke out. This was a very sobering moment for all of us as we realized that we were going into a situation that was not entirely safe. I don't think that any of us had been unaware of this at any time, but this became dramatically evident to us when we were told how to fall and how to relax if we were kicked or struck in any way. We were also instructed not to lift our hands in any action of self-defense, because this would be interpreted as an attack on our part. Sunday morning dawned bright and beautiful in Jackson, Mississippi. It was a glorious Sunday. We started to the church from the campus of Tougaloo College at approximately 10 o'clock. I don't think I have ever made a tenser journey in my life. We had been warned that we might be stopped by roadblocks of white Citizens Council people who were alerted to our presence in the area. We were stopped once, and we thought that we would not make it to the church. It developed that the two cars that had stopped in the middle of the road in front of us were actually not trying to detain us, and we were able to get to Jackson without any difficulty. We went by COFO, which is a sort of council for coordinating the efforts of Negro and white leaders in the movement in Jackson, Mississippi. There we picked up the two young Negroes who were to go to church with us, Mr. David Walker of Combe, Mississippi, and Mr. Robert Talbert of Jackson, Mississippi. Mr. Walker, I believe, is 22, and Mr. Talbert, 19. These two young men were literally risking their lives by accompanying us in this attempt to worship in the Capitol Street Methodist Church. In the anteroom of the COFO headquarters, we had just a few moments for meditation. The chaplain of Tougaloo College read Psalm 122 for us before we started to the church. Then we stepped out on the sidewalk. The chaplain told us that Deputy Chief Ray was across the street in a police cruiser. While we were waiting on the sidewalk, at least five different police cruisers passed by. One cruiser with a police dog in the back, a deliberate attempt, of course, to intimidate the Negroes, and I'm sure to intimidate us. Eventually, we got into two cars and drove to the Capitol Street Methodist Church. We got out of the cars and assembled on the sidewalk. There were nine in our party, the seven theologians, so to speak, and the two Negroes. We started up the sidewalk and were approaching the steps of the Capitol Street Methodist Church. There were a group of ushers on the steps, and as they saw us nearing the steps, they rushed over to bar our way. The spokesman of the group, whom I later was able to identify at the trial as a Mr. Cox, said, "That's far enough, don't come any farther," and the ushers were stretched out in a line in front of us. Our party spread out on the sidewalk and spilled over on the grass, and one member seemed to be going around the line of ushers, and the spokesman said that there would be no end runs. And when he said that, we remained completely motionless. I had been asked to speak for our group, and so I said to the usher, "We are Methodist Christians who would like to worship the risen Lord with you in this church today." Mr. Cox replied, "You aren't going to integrate this church. The policy of the official board of this church is to deny admission to all Negroes. You can stand here all day, but you aren't coming into this church." And then I asked him, "Do you mean that we can stand here?" And he said, "No, you must move on." I'm a little bit ashamed of my dialogue here. It's not very imaginative. I asked why. The usher answered, "There will be no questions and no answers. If you don't move on at once, I will ask the police to put you under arrest." At that point, I repeated our desire to enter the church and to worship in the Capitol Street Methodist Church. And then the usher turned to a group of police officers. Now, I did not mention the fact that when we came to church, there were several police officers inside, anywhere from a half a dozen to a dozen around this particular intersection. And immediately as we approached the church, these police officers could be seen converging behind the ushers. So Mr. Cox, the head usher, or the spokesman of the usher, turned to one of these officers and he said, "Officer, take them away." And then the officer stepped in front of Mr. Cox, right in front of me, and he said to me, "Do you understand what you have been told?" And I said, "Yes." He then said to me, "If you don't move on, I will place you under arrest." And then I said, "I guess you'll have to arrest us." And the officer said, "You're all under arrest." And he asked us to move off of the sidewalk that led up to the church and to stand on the curb of the street, waiting for the patrol wagon. And while he was standing there, I asked him whether we would have been arrested if the usher had not requested him to do so. And he replied that no arrest would have been made if the usher had not asked for it. I think it's important for you to know that during all of these events that transpired in front of the church, the usher's voice was not raised and my voice was not raised. I was not speaking as loudly as I'm speaking to you at this moment. There were no hostile gestures made. There was no congregating of people around us. And there was no possibility of anything that we said or did disrupting the worship service inside the church.
Following this arrest, we were taken to the Jackson City Jail. Here we were interrogated, fingerprinted, and photographed with a number, and taken to our cell. The seven professors, white professors, were placed in one cell. The two Negro young men who accompanied us were placed in another. I should stress that our treatment during the 2 days in jail at the hands of the Jackson police was quite decent. Pretty clearly, they did not want the name of Jackson to be tarnished further by anything they did to us. There was then no rough handling of us. Several times we were addressed gentlemen. Food was okay. The best jail food we had ever had. The bunks were hard. No sheets were provided, no pillows, but one could sleep on them with a little effort. It was clear to us, however, that our treatment in jail was unusual. We had heard accounts of beatings administered by police to other white people who had been arrested in connection with civil rights actions. And their attitude, the police's police attitude, and the jailer's attitude toward the Negro prisoners was, I think, unforgettably revealed to us by a comment of our jailer. He told us one of the days that there were four Negro girls in a cell down from us, 9 years old, who had been arrested and placed in jail. The jailer said they were like bitches in heat, and that he was doing all that he could to help to keep the male Negro prisoners from them. In the 2 days we were in jail, our spirit remained high. I guess this was the most remarkable cell group that we had ever been in. Our morale was helped in no small measure by telegrams that we received from friends. And I should say that the first we received was signed Mathesco students, and we are deeply appreciative of that. Our first visitors were two Roman Catholic priests from Jackson, one of them a recent graduate of the seminary down the road, the Josephina. Their visit and their prayer with us meant a great deal. Monday afternoon, about 4:30, we were taken downstairs to municipal court. Here there were 2 hours of testimony. Only two of the defendants actually testified, Mr. Dunn and Mr. Thompson. We were defended by a Negro lawyer, one of three in Mississippi, Mr. Brown, a very remarkable, spirited person. The charge against us was disturbing public worship. After testimony, the judge declared us guilty. The sentence, you know. I think it's interesting for you to know also what the judge told us. We have a newspaper account from Jackson that I want to quote now, as they quote the judge. Judge Spencer said the issue is crystal clear. Does a church congregation have the right to worship in the manner they want to? And does another group have the right to tell that congregation to adhere to another policy? Looking at the nine members of the group sitting in front of the bench, the judge said, you should have known that similar groups as you were arrested here for trying the same thing that you tried. You should have known or been told that church officials have taken a policy stand in this matter, and they intend to keep to it unless they announce differently. Just as you gentlemen feel equally strong about certain issues, so too this congregation and other persons have strong feelings. This was the judicial reasoning to support the charge of guilty because of disturbing the public worship. The sentence was appealed and has been appealed to the Hinds County Chancery Court. Following the sentencing by the judge, efforts were immediately begun, or continued because the preliminary stages had already been begun, to raise bond money for us. That money came from many sources across the country. Again, some of it from this place, and for that too, we deeply appreciate it. Tuesday, about 12:15 p.m., we were released, and by 4 o'clock that afternoon, we were on our way back to Ohio.
Well, we have 2 minutes until the next class convenes, so maybe we better just save our questions until 1 o'clock. I speak on behalf of the student body, and we appreciate your sharing with us this experience, and we will look forward to meeting you at 1 o'clock in the lounge of the next door.